So, the topic I picked for tonight is what it means to be Jewish. And there are a number of reasons for picking that topic. The first one is that I had to pick the title far enough in advance, so I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to say. What it means to be Jewish is a very broad topic. And you can usually fit almost anything into that. The second reason is that as part of my teaching at Gann Academy, where I do a bunch of technical things, including an athletics class that Dan took, I wonder all the time whether what I say has a real impact on students. Oh, but maybe I should be going directly for immediate relevance and meaning. So tonight was that experiment to see if I could actually go for the broad speaking topic on that subject. Now, the question, what does it mean to be Jewish? We should start by getting into that. We can answer the question philosophically and say, what it means to be Jewish is that I have a Jewish mother and I obviously go into conversion. Or we could answer it sociologically and say, what it means to be Jewish is to belong to a Jewish community. Or we could say, we could answer it ontologically and say, what it means to be Jewish is to have a Jewish soul. And then we could have a whole lecture about that. You know, have some things about what exactly constitutes a Jewish soul, or what exactly constitutes a philosophy conversion, or what is Jewish community. But I don't want to do any of those things. We're going to bracket all those. Now that means that there's a given that what it means to be Jewish is not going to be true for all Jews. That they're making a claim of abstraction. We could try and turn it into what it means to be authentically Jewish, but that would of course get us into polemics. So they try to say that this is a partial definition of what it means to be Jewish, as if constructed to some degree philosophically and to some degree psychologically, and as we go through it, we'll see what I mean by that. So how do we begin answering the question, what does it mean to be Jewish? And it looks like people are not really good at it. So I want to start by saying the problem of the question, what does it mean to be Jewish, is that it implies that being Jewish is something different than being Jewish. And that's, I take that as a problem. Right? I don't take that as an obvious truth, I take that as a problem. But that raises the question of, so when we talk about what it means to be particularistically Jewish, right, what's the point at which you start, right, in which you're willing to begin talking about what it means to be Jewish as opposed to what it means to be Jewish? So we could take the starting point, and I'm going to begin the starting point to the Ten Commandments. Although one should recognize that in America, that's a very problematic thing to say, because in America, the Ten Commandments are sort of the symbol of universalism, as opposed to particularistic religion. When you want to claim, well, look, we're just talking about the Judeo-Christian tradition, you put up the Ten Commandments, and certainly most Americans do not perceive the Ten Commandments as something Jewish. And one way of understanding that is by taking a look at the way Maimonides reads the preamble to the Ten Commandments. As Maimonides says, even Shabbat is not such a big deal because the original is in Arabic anyway, but they don't have to say, so we don't discuss the translation anyway. Actually, the translation here is very controversial. So Maimonides says in his Book of Commandments, he says Commandment number one is the opening of the Ten Commandments. And he claims that even though it's just to point out that the Torah does not actually say Ten Commandments, the Torah says Ten Stations, but the tradition that it has to include Ten Commandments, you can do that in a couple of ways, but he assumes that the opening statement, I am the Lord your God, is a commandment. Now what is a command? So obviously, the first mitzvah is the command by which he commanded us to believe in divinity. To believe that there is a God, but it could be that there is a transcendent, dimension, however you want to frame it. Meaning, we must believe that there is a purpose and cause which activates all existence, which is Koyotan Sa'im, and this is the intent of saying, I am Hashem your God. Now that understanding of I am Hashem your God, basically leaves out the York. It just says, I am Hashem God. And there's no particular reason that it should be directed to Jews as opposed to anybody else. And because there's nothing about a relationship between God and the Jews, and it sounds like what you're supposed to believe in is a philosophic abstraction. Okay, so this, which raises even the question, when the Arabic word that believe is Yitzhakad, and there's a whole controversy over Yitzhakad really means to believe or to know, because maybe this is the kind of thing about which, you know, that's so complicated among other Jews that believe, there's a silly thing to say. Right? It's like saying, I believe in quantum mechanics. I really need to believe in quantum mechanics. Do I understand quantum mechanics or no? Okay. Now, Nachmanides is wrong, interesting. Nachmanides says that, that Nachmanides, in the sense of a work called Al-Post-Jolot, a much earlier work, not Nachmanides says it makes no, in the sense of that work, is it makes no sense to interpret the opening of the Ten Commandments as a commandment, because let's suppose I commanded you to believe in this. Now, unless you already did, why would you listen to this? Your imagination is the only thing. Therefore, you can't argue that it is a commandment to believe in God, because obviously belief in God has to be taken as the premise for all future commandments. And that makes the archaeologists happy, because the archaeologists think that the commandments are parallel to the various kinds of ancient Near Eastern treaties, which began by having the Lord say, the Lord. Usually, for some reason, they described it as hit by suzerainty trees. And I see this morning, correctly, but I said that was pretty, it's a suzerainty tree, but I'm sure that none of them will ever use the word suzerainty in any other context. Such as they feel like insisting on that. So they're happier with the notion that Anokesha is not a commandment but an introduction. And in that universe also, there's nothing particularistically Jewish necessarily about it. But to me, the most interesting reading of the opening is that of the Sefer Mitzvot Gedolot, which is Moshe Tzutzi, who I believe was in France somewhere in the late 13th, early 14th century, although I'm entirely unreliable about this. But he was in some of my information, comes from an entirely mistaken romantic novel written in Germany in the 19th century called The Count Mitzvot. Which came about because for some reason Rav Moshe Tzutzi was called the Tzar Mitzvotzi, and that in somebody's imagination meant that he was a nobleman. And in the 19th century there was a fun genre of works of romantic novels. If you ever have any interest in that, you can go look up Dr. Marcus Lehmann's romantic novels. There are a lot of stuff. No, there's all these kinds of them published by Feldman. They used to read them to me in text. Much better than what but at that point, in the late 19th century, the Romantic movement was the competition for traditional orthodoxy, and you have all these stories about students in yeshiva teaching romantic novels under the Gemara, and things like that. So that's the story. So why don't we write some romantic novels? And then it was some teachers' list. So that's it. Anyway, so that's really good to be a side view in the historical figure, although I know very little. But what we do know is that when he wrote his collection of commandments called the Sefer Mitzvot Gedolot, he wrote it essentially with Maimonides in front of him. And so all his deviations from Maimonides are deliberate and significant. And right at the very beginning, he makes a dramatically different move as to what the first commandment is. He doesn't accept the position that it isn't a commandment. But he says, right, he has a fascinating read of the commandment. He says is, and here was the original Hebrew, so far as he it's not necessary, right, there's a positive commandment to believe, the Otoshna Kamaj et a Torah Bahar Sinai Lidei Moshe Rabbeinu. Looks like it was translated to Max while they were on to the photo. It was in Hebrew. He was on the step and says it's because the God who took us out of the Torah at Mount Sinai, who gave us the Torah at Mount Sinai and Moshe Rabbeinu, he is the Shem God who took us out of Mitzrayim. And that's the meaning of what he said at the time he gave the Torah, I am Hashem, God who took you out of the land of, your God who took you out of the land of Mitzrayim. So he is much more sensitive to the language of the text than the other readings, because he focuses on your God, and he explains why he took you out of Egypt, which Maimonides doesn't really have a great explanation for. And what he says is that the first commandment of the Torah is to identify the God who has revealed himself to the Jews of Sinai with the God who took the Jews out of Egypt. Now, you might think, they went through Egypt, and one thing all of a sudden, after one God has taken out Egypt, the only time they wonder is that another God can't get in close. I reveal myself them now, right now, and of course they could solve this by saying, I have worked with God out of Egypt, and that would reveal that, you know, no one would be able to go through an imposture. Very, very strange if you take it as a specific intellectual instruction. What I want to suggest is that what the Tanakh really means is that the first commandment is to identify as the commanding God with the God who took you out of Egypt, and that means that taking us out of Egypt stood for, like, stood for something. And then the God is on the side of the enslaved against the, against the enslavers, among other things, and that you should take that as the animating spirit of the command. You have to always, interpret the interpret the command at Sinai as being commands that could have been given by the God who intervened to take you out of Egypt. The question then is, what is the meaning? Right? What is it that we are supposed to learn from the experience of having been taken out of Egypt? I want to get to that in a couple of different ways. We'll end up, right, the last 25 minutes or so, what we're doing is going through a whole host of places in the Torah where it says you have to do this because you were in Egypt. But I want to develop a somewhat more complicated philosophic argument before we get there, which will in turn change the way I think that we understand the experience of Egypt. But I want to get there by means of a text that is often understood as common. Although I think that's an error. So I'll teach it to you initially in the way that you usually understood, and then I will I'll try and go back and change that meaning. So the text is the text I'm talking about is the introduction to a book called the Chazari, which is written by Yehuda Levi, who was in Spain somewhere around the early 11th century, I think, although again I'm not in history. Famous as a poet, among other things. But this is a work which is what I call a philosophical historical novel or something like that. At some point earlier, maybe kind of the 8th century, there was a kingdom in the former Soviet Union known as the Khazar Kingdom, or the Tatarstan, I guess. And at some point, there was a disputation in that kingdom, and as a result of which, large numbers of at least the upper class of Tatarstan converted to Judaism. So Yehuda Levi claims to have the transcript of the disputation. And that's what the Kuzari is, right? It's a presumably fictionalized transcript of the disputation. Now, the way he presents it is the king of the Khazars has a dream. In that dream, an angel appears to him and says, God loves your intentions, but not your deeds. And this dream happens repeatedly, and the king of the Khazars is motivated to find out what's wrong with my deeds. The first thing he does is he tries to become the firmest Khazar you can be, the local pagan religion, and he served as high priest, and he brought sacrifices and all that. No matter what he did, every night the angel still comes to him and says, I have an exception between your intentions are desirable, but not definitely between your actions are not. So, recognizing that the Tatar religion is a dead end, he decides to call an expert to have him, right, to find out what the proper thing to do is. So the first person he called him is a philosopher. And he asked the philosopher what to do, right, what religion should I follow? And the philosopher says, it really doesn't matter. As long as your religion is consistent with the dictates of reason, right, all this ritual stuff is just an overlay and doesn't make a quite as big a difference. You can be a Christian, you can be a Muslim, it makes no difference. It makes no difference at all. So the king says, it really makes no difference at all, and all the followers of those religion are satisfied with not the religion, why are they keep telling each other? And at that point, he just dismisses the philosopher because he says, if you are right that reason can tell me what to do, then why do people keep telling each other who are being reasonable about what to do? So the philosopher gets a little bit and walks out saying, and by the way, only philosophers have two dreams. So he's not from the king, right? Because all things, all basis is a dream. So then he calls in a Christian. And he asks the Christian what you believe, and the Christian tells him the story of the incarnation, I think. I'm not sure if he talks about forgiveness of sin. It's a very interesting presentation of Christianity. And I think he certainly tells him the story of the incarnation and the virgin birth and the whole gamut. And the king looks at him and says, wow, if I had an experience with grace, if I had a Christian experience, I'm sure that would make perfect sense to me. Because people, it's a very powerful statement, because people always rationalize their experiences. nobody is ever going to reject their experience, their really powerful experience, just because it doesn't make sense. But I have had a Christian experience, so this is ridiculous. And I think every time a Christian has gone. So he brings in a Muslim. And they have to know them, well, you believe in the Muslim, gives them, you know, a thesis of the belief of Islam, which they can't cut judgment on how accurate it is or not. And then he says, well, why do you believe this? And the Muslim says, which is offended Muslim polemic, because the Quran is the most beautiful of all books, and Muhammad was illiterate, so how could you have written the most beautiful of all books if it wasn't divinely inspired? Which the king said, that's really interesting, but I don't regard it. And that's when the Muslim has gone to the and right, and he calls them the Jews. And here's what the Jews are. Right? Well, we'll go through it. At the opening of common law, these arguments are really good arguments. Right? That's why this is often taken just as the necessary comment, right? The necessary comment from which people begin some serious philosophy. I'm going to argue that it's actually central to the argument of the book. But first I want to read what the Jews says, and then I'll try and explain what I think happens in all those opening sections. Yes, right? Well, actually, the really interesting thing is he doesn't mention the Karaite. And even though at various points in the long, and you know, after to get past this, we have a 500-page conversation with the Jews, right? And he mentions it several times that the Karaites are really impressive and they're much stronger than the Rabbinic Jews are. But he never brings the Karaites into the discussion. That's always true. Leo Strauss has a fun piece in which he argues that the philosopher has to be gotten off stage because he's too convincing, and we have to get it out of the way. It really is just a book, an attack on philosophy. And I thought Strauss was not convincing because really if this book is afraid of anything, it's terrorism. The terrorism never even allows to appear on stage. And it seems like that's really what the enemy is. But if you take that reading. But I don't answer that. You know, I mean, you didn't call them calling Hindu either. You know, he's basically only interested in the religions that are live options for the Jews or his audience. This is not a conversion. This is not an outreach to conversion book. This is a serious book. So he's only trying to get people away from the religions that they see as live alternatives. If he had thought that the Jews are dangerous, that was considering Hinduism, he would have put Hinduism in also. Okay, so Machado says, I see that it is necessary to ask the Jews if they are the remnants of the children of Israel, and I see they are the basis for all argument that God is an instruction for Israel, because both the Christian and the Muslim expect the authenticity of Torah in their presentation. And the philosopher really doesn't care about anyone. So the Jews said to him, we believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who took the children of Israel out of Mitzrayim with signs and wonders, who fed them in the desert, who gave them the land of Israel for taking them across the Jordan with their wonders, who sent Moses with the Torah, after the Torah, after the thousand prophets warning us, keep that Torah, etc., etc. We believe all that is written in that Torah would take a long time to say it all. Okay, so the Jew gives a great speech, and the response to that great speech is the king says, ah, I knew I shouldn't have asked the Jews, so they have nothing to say. I correctly concluded not to ask the Jews. I knew they had lost their memories and wisdom, as lowliness and poverty have stripped them of all positive traits. Should you have not said, O Jew, that you believe in the creator of the world, who arranges and organizes it, and who created you and sent you? These are the arguments of all religious men, which drive them to seek the truth and to imitate the creator in righteousness and wisdom. In other words, what the king says to the Jew is, what are you giving me the God? You should have given me the Rambam. Right? The first commandment always is to believe in the God who is the God of all the universe, and thereby, as opposed to the God who took you out of Egypt and then demanded you to sign it. Right? So you're all wrong, Jews. Okay, but the Jew says, what you would say is true of rational, conventional religion arrived at via analysis. But such religion is subject to many doubts, and if you ask the philosophers, you'll find you can't agree on their action or opinion. Because they're mere arguments for some which there's proof, some which seem compelling, and some which don't seem compelling, and which there's certainly no proof. So, I answered you, the Jew of Kabir said, that God began his speech to the masses of Israel with, Anelki Hashem Lutef HaShur Tekif from Eretz Yisrael, I am Hashem, the God who took you out of Yisrael, and not with, I am the creator of the world. Right? God didn't begin at Sinai with Bereshit, the Genesis, right? Because when you asked me for my belief, I told you the basis of my obligation and that of the community of Israel, which was made clear to them at Sinai through their own witness, and afterwards through ongoing tradition of his life witnessing, and Machado says, if so, I see that your Torah was given only to you? And the Jew says, yes. And it's only given to us and to Sanhedrin. The Khazari tradition on Sanhedrin is often presented as creating really large distinctions between born Jews and converts. I think that's wrong, but I'm just telling you that I'm cutting this off at the point where you just said that Jews are just like converts. Most people presenting the Khazari to you will tell you that the next section is really important. I think that's wrong, but I can't do that with you tonight. So I'm just asking you to take it on faith. That the Khazari doesn't actually make, the Khazari doesn't really make this a distinction. Okay. So, often when people present the Khazari, so you say, initially there's a comic relief, where we get the philosophers, which is the Christian and the Muslim on stage, and then the Jew comes in and makes a rational argument and says, 600,000 people couldn't lie. And at that, you will find many, many websites which say that the rationally compelling proof of Judaism is that Judaism engaged in a mass revelation and 300,000 people couldn't lie. Now that is not, I think, a very good argument, because first of all, 300,000 people could lie. Secondly, 600,000 people could have an asbestosis. Thirdly, one person could lie that 300,000 people fit this. So if you try and present this as a rational argument, it doesn't compel me. But I think you're not later smart enough to understand it. So I want to try and find a way in which that argument is a really serious argument, and the rejection of the previous three figures really matters. Here's what I want to say. The philosopher, the Christian, and the Muslim all make universal claims. Right? Reason is binding on all human beings. Christianity is binding on all human beings, so there's no salvation outside the church, which was a universal doctrine. Christianity takes it that way. It's still a matter of controversy, whether it's true or not. And Islam also makes a universal claim that everyone has to accept it. So the Khazar, the Khazari makes the claim that if you are going to make the assertion that your beliefs are binding on all human beings, then you have to have evidence that could plausibly convince all human beings. Evidence all human beings have access to and should reasonably be convinced by, otherwise you're being unfair. Right? It's a version of the classic argument where you're like, so how can you claim that children have been baptized to the hell? Right? And then he says, well look, obviously, Mr. Philosopher, reason is not, you can't bind people, judge people's actions by expecting that they behave properly because they should have figured out reasonably, because look, all these people live by reason and they can't agree. So reason is not a reliable guide to true action, and people cannot be held accountable for failing to reach the right conclusion by a reason. Christianity requires you to have an experience, you assert, well I didn't have it, and you can't ask me to have an experience I haven't had, but I mean, I have an experience you don't. And Islam requires me to be fluent in the language that I'm not fluent in. Not to mention to have a decent aesthetic sense of what literature is. You know, if only you could read Arabic, but be, I'm not hoping anybody would be a student hate fan. And what good is that going to do to try to figure out that the Khazari is the most beautiful book of all time? So,
the argument right now is that universally, religions, the doctrines which make universal claims need to have universally compelling evidence.
But Judaism does not make universal claims.
Yes.
It has to be evidence that any human being looking at should be convinced by. That you can hold them accountable for failing, right? So you can say, you're doing the wrong thing, and you should know that you're doing the wrong thing because you had access to reason, right? You had access to the Quran, you should have been able to figure out it was the right book, etc. So what makes Judaism unique philosophically is that Judaism is only binding on Jews. Okay. Now I have a question. So Judaism is only binding on Jews, and that's what matters. But if Judaism is binding on Jews, and you have to have an argument which should be compelling to all Jews. Okay. So this is where it does not make the claim 600,000 people couldn't lie as such. It says that either is compelling to everybody, or it's not compelling to anybody. Being Jewish doesn't change the nature of the argument. What he says is the following, right? He's looking at his language as careful. He says, because, right, we believe in the basis of obligations and having an individual, which was made clear to them as Sinai through their own witness,
and afterward to ongoing tradition, which is like witnessing.
What does he mean by that claim?
And afterward to ongoing tradition, which is like witnessing.
So in order to explain that, I want to use a distinction from a historian, Joseph Hirschhausen, who wrote a book about a very famous book, The Holocaust, called Zakor, which I can tell you later, some of the excerpts of Jesus special one. And in there, he makes a distinction between memory and history. Okay, as I understand it, one of his claims is that American Jews are in crisis because we no longer think of the Jewish past as memory, we think of it instead as history. And memory is what happens to you, and history is what happens to other people. And the difference between memory and history in those terms is none of you need proof to believe that the things you saw are real. Unless you find a totally outlandish. You don't need proof for your own experience. Right? Other people's experience, you delay thinking whether they're true or false based on whether they have externally objectively available evidence. But anything that you experience yourself, that's the truth. That's who you are. Okay, then you make the second move. The second move is that it's not only true of your own experiences that you think that way. Because you work on the assumption, it's not always true, you know that, but you work on the assumption that what you know about your childhood, which is what your parents tell you, what your family tells you, you work on the assumption that that's true also. And when you construct your identity, you say, who am I? You tell a story which begins at birth and with the information that you learned from your parents. Not because you think your parents are great historians, but because it's part of who you are. And it's perhaps you, what is the definition of what does it mean to be you? What it means to be you is that you have a story, and that story includes the things that your family told you about who you are, and the things that you know, happen to you. So, yes.
I think the problem a lot of people have, this is one reason people think of the word is just memory, is because they feel for some reason, I don't know, if it's good or not, that people who are telling them tradition have a vested interest in, like, do we have this game something like all the time.
Sure. And if you think that about, right, and there are people who later think that about their parents, who legitimately? Right? You know, tell them lots of kids are raised with their parents pretending that they're the biological children, they're adopted. Right. People have all sorts of narratives. They have take out any bookshelf. There'll be lots and lots of books about people discovering their discovering that parents have all sorts of spiritual information from them. But on the whole, a society which presumes that you have to verify everyone in society has to verify everything their parents told them about them, is a pathological society. It's not a healthy society where everyone has no idea who they are. You get novels out of it, and you get autobiographies out of it, but it's not a healthy way to live as a society. So what the Cesari argues is that in the same way that identifying as you means accepting your memories pre-critically. Your memories are true until proven false, not the other way around. And the same way that part of being you is that you accept your family story. That's part of what it means to be you is that your family story is true pre-critically. I think might be provable false, and you work on the assumption they're true until then. So he argues is that being Jewish means accepting the natural memory. And it's not because you think the national memory is provable to somebody else any more than you can prove your family story to somebody else, but because it's part of who you are. Right? Once you're Jewish, so being a healthy Jew means accepting the Jewish narrative, all right, as memory as opposed to a history. And there we say, look, certainly an essential element of the Jewish memory the story that constitutes us as Jews is that God took us out of Egypt and gave us the Torah of Sinai. Okay, so I want to argue that stage one of the answer to the question, what does it mean to be Jewish,
that it needs to be Jewish is to have Jewish memory, not to know Jewish history, right, but to have Jewish memory. And having Jewish memory means that the things that constitute us as Jews are true to you pre-critically, as opposed to by demonstration. And that, I think, is the essential argument of that section of the Kuzar. Now, if you accept that as a premise, that at least part of the definition of being Jewish is accepting Jewish memory, and specifically that what it means to have Jewish memory is focused on, as the Kuzar says, is focused on being having had the experience of being taken out of Egypt and then commanded at Sinai. So it turns out very nicely that the second is supposed to go look. Actually, the first commandment is what defines you as a Jew. Right? It's seeing, right, not necessarily, it's seeing these two experiences as being connected. Right? It's the movement from Sinai. It's the movement from Sinai to from Egypt to Sinai. That is the constituting memory of Judaism. Now that means that we can give a great deal of significance now, not just to the first commandment, but to the commandment to remember the Exodus. And because the commandment to remember the Exodus fundamentally is a commandment to be a Jew. But here I want to point out an intensifier in that, there are two mitzvot of remembering the Exodus of Egypt. One of them is a daily mitzvah, fulfilled that day in the third quarter of the Shemot by today. And the other is a unique mitzvah that only occurs on the first night of Pesach, or the first 2 nights of the Exodus. Now, does somebody tell me what's one major difference between the mitzvah that occurs every day and the mitzvah that occurs on the night of Passover? There you go.
My thing was, when it occurs in the day, it's not to just remember.
Yeah. Okay, good. And Pesach is supposed to, right? Pesach you have to tell the story and not only tell it to yourself. We can try to tell it to somebody else, but you're trying to transmit. Right. So the next generation can remember also. Right, yes? Okay, very good. And the second distinction is that on the other days you're supposed to remember it, that's the term we use for now. So on the first night of Pesach, you're supposed to imagine yourself as if you were there. So what I want to suggest is that fundamentally, the rest of the year is closer to history, and the purpose of the Seder is to make it memory. Right, really, I might want to argue that the mitzvah of the rest of the year is to incorporate the first night of Passover into the memory. Now, the first night of Passover is when you experience it, and the rest of the year you remember that experience, as opposed to remembering it as something somebody else told you. Okay, now that has that at least according to the sixth, I think it is, has a halakhic implication, which is that on the only day the full hallel, on the first night of Passover. The reason for that is we only have hallel the other night. So the reason given that we won't say the full hallel the other night is famous Talmudic statement which says that when the Jews were profiting the Yom Tov, the Reed Sea, as a result of God putting it, so the angels the angels tried to think about it to glorify his power, and God said, not saying it as a thing, but yeah, let's say, what's in the hand of God in the ocean? What are you doing singing when I'm doing that? Right? So we don't sing on Pesach because God told the angels not to sing. So there's something that you've all seen the movie, and what do the Jews do? They sing, right? They sing, right? And it doesn't sound like, you know, an arrogant Exodus, even though the song, you know, Exodus happens a little bit later than it does in the movie. But it doesn't sound in the narrative. It actually is that God was upset because of Jews' sin. So there has to be a distinction between the Jews and me. And the distinction is that when you hear about a situation in which God saves some people at the expense of others, even if you have a rooting interest, you still can't think about it. Because ultimately, right, some of God's handiwork suffers. But if you were the ones being saved, then you have an obligation to express gratitude. Right? You're not supposed to be thinking about it objectively. You're supposed to be thinking, look, God just did this amazing thing for me. You're not supposed to be thinking objectively. So on the first night of Pesach, when we are supposed to imagine ourselves as being saved ourselves, we can say the Kohala, because we're in the position of the Jews. But on the other side of Passover, we're in the position of the angels. So we can't sit. Okay, that's one implication of that distinction between experience, experience and memory. But there is one other distinction, I think, between the Mitzvah of the spring year and the Mitzvah of the first night of the year. So this is a finish, but it may not be true, but I want to re-suggest it, which is that during the year, the Mitzvah is only to remember that God took us out of Egypt. You look at the third part of the Krishna, where the method is to say, look, I ain't got to take out of Egypt. But at the same time, there is an obligation to remember Egypt, and then that God took us out of it. They must still be good when they're playing the show. And at least one of the two understandings of it, one is an ideological understanding that we were idolaters and then God gave us Sinai, and the other is that we were slaves and then God took us down to the show. So that's why I want to bring it to the last section of this year, is that idea that the fundamental experience that constitutes us as Jews requires us not just to have remember that God took us out of Egypt, but that we were in Egypt.
Now I'm trying to root that in the text itself. If you take a look at the last. So verse number one. So really at the moment when Abraham first really begins changing his conception from individual to national, the Greek and Ashkenazim, so what God says to him, God says to Abraham, Yezoa Tedar, and that's what we must know, he gary yezarachah the earth over him, Yavazum the Yerusham, Abraham Yerushana. Right? You might pretty much know that your descendants will be Gerim, in a land not their own. Okay, so this notion, right, and that we think at least was largely fulfilled by the Jews and the Egyptians. So we have at the moment that really God is trying to transform Abraham into a Jew. And when he tells them the thing you have to know about being a Jew is that being a Jew involves having been being a bear in a land not their own. Now to bring that home, In Exodus 3:22, which is the story of Moshe when he's still in Midian. Now the fascinating thing about Moshe, the Jewish leader, is that he has no Jewish family, as far as you can tell. He has no Jewish identity until God speaks to him. There is a moment, which will become very important, there is a moment when Moshe is living as an Egyptian, and the verse says he grew up and he went out to his brothers, and he saw an Egyptian man striking a Jewish man from among his brothers. And I think the regular reading of that is that there's a moment in which Moshe's conception of who his brothers are shifts. Right? He says his brothers twice in the because all of a sudden he recognizes that, whoa, I could be that person, not that person. And so that's the moment when he has perhaps a conception of Jewish identity, but it passes, because the next time the Jews are up and you're on the way to Midian, and there's a perfectly happy life. As an Egyptian living in Midian, when Kippur is season, we go to the Egyptian team, they say, right, all they see is an Egyptian man, they don't know anything about the Egyptian. But even in that period, the most living as a pure Midianite, he has a son, and what he says is, I call my son Gershom, saying, I have been a gear in an alien land, meaning that he goes through the experience that God told Abraham was central to being good. And of being a gear in a land not his own. Now what does that mean, to be a gear? So if you take a look at
the third verse, which is in the Rehoboam in Chronicles. So it says there, right? So this is a broad statement. All human beings are given relative to God because God owns the land, and all of us are just given. Okay, so we're picking up on that theme. All human beings are given, and to be Jewish is to have internalized that conception of what it means to write, what it means for human beings, that all of us are right, that there's really no difference for everybody who do. And that has a lot of implications for person before. We say the artist will seem a fairly consistent one, can't sell land and into eternity. To be the artist, because God says the land belongs to me. So you're even supposed to be my family, right? Because no human being has a right to claim a permanent connection to land. Right? You can't make the distinction between the home person and the outsider, because if you remember, then all of us, right, all of us fundamentally are just tenants on God's land, then then you recognize that there's no basis for discrimination. Okay. How does this play out? So we take a look at verse number the fifth verse. Anyway, so the first level is the care looks in Ed looks up tenants. He did not send the earth to Zion. He should not upset or torment the air, for you were there and blind in the time. So the experience of having been in Egypt, and it has a halakhic implication, which required you not to oppress the air. Please note, I have avoided translating the term air. The term air has three meanings in the Arabic literature. One is you can simply be a stranger, or alien, if you can say it's a stranger, you can avoid pointing that it's green. And like that, right? Non-citizen. It also refers to a gift for a child, which is essentially an undue with a green card. A resident alien, alien, right? And lastly, the gift cynic was a naturalized citizen, and a full counter. Now, there is some lofty discussion as to which the quote here relates to. I like to call it the traditions of the Fedonist Post-Timers and the Fedonist Science, that they apply to all strangers. Just because in a Jewish society, the most likely strangers around are going to be resident aliens and naturalized citizens. So we use the term guarantee because it applies to them primarily. Okay, the first thing we learn is that we're not supposed to oppress or torment Aaron because we were given. Now that sounds to me like a straightforward justice argument. Right? Don't do unto others what you would not want others to do unto you. That's a very simple, it's a low level argument. The second verse, the Gerlos was tough, that can be never to Ger, he guaranteed to have a child. The second stage goes to what I would call sympathy. It's not that people did bad things to you, so you shouldn't do bad things to others. It's people did bad things to you and you know what it felt like. Right, so you shouldn't do it to them. Okay, then you go, right, the third verse goes further and says, the Haskenet of Ger. Somehow, because you were strangers in Egypt, therefore you should love strangers. Now that's the, right, that's the more dramatic view. It's not just sympathy, as I know you feel. And I share enough of your experience. Right, because there's a bond between us. I would call it moving from sympathy to empathy. Right, and the last line is, this is verse number 8. You see, a great friend of Gerrit writes a temple to do so. Okay, that you can yell at him, Hagar is them. They have to love come over. And the last stage is that it's not just enough to have empathy, you actually have to identify. Right? You have to love the hair as if you were yourself. Right? So what I suggest is that if you say that the defining element of being Jewish is to have the memory of Egypt, so then somebody who has a memory that is parallel to that, right? Somebody who has also been a gear in Eretz Yisrael, somebody who is in the position of maturity. So that, right, so they are very much like you, because they have a constant memory. It's particularly like this, but it's not just the same. Okay, right, all this is brought home, I think, when we see that the place in which the Torah says that there should be no legal distinction between gear and others is the Passover sacrifice. At the moment of the Passover sacrifice, if you think it replaced the distinction because that's the your Caesar's memory is critical, you say no.
And there has to be one law for you and for the good.
Question?
If you're saying somebody doesn't share one memory to you,
yes.
That's a constitute memory to you.
Yeah.
Is that saying just the viewing who are among you or any oppressed people you should have a bond with?
So last time, yes, again, I touched it off completely, it depends on what you're saying. I think that there is a significant bond, right, between other people who see that as a primary memory. The bond is strengthened if they take the same lessons you do. But I think, yeah, I think the argument is made on to a certain degree universal level as well. Right, it's a possible co-op. That means that if somebody, right, that because you're trained to do your DNA in Egypt, therefore you should. And even ethologically, when one looks at the convert, it makes no sense to say we should love the convert if you do a convert in Egypt. Right? It makes there may be legal reasons to say that, but it makes no sense exactly, and it should be acknowledged. If we limit it that way, right, it turns to the risk of the number. Okay. I want to just point out one last thing, which I think is probably the least expect. So we would say, so what constitutes the whole Jewish entity is, well, they were mean to us, so we should not be mean to people because they were mean to us and we didn't like it. But in the peculiar halakha, which is verse 10, it says, look, the Eved of Yid should not abominate the Eved translation. For the record, because it shows up a lot of other contexts of what the word abomination means, in Johnson's dictionary, abomination is a loosely interpreted term of offender. Now, I think something like that, you know, maybe the same thing as is the addition of the lost photographer and the harmless judge, but nonetheless, it's probably reasonable to know what the term abomination meant. I mean, the choir is just male in English, which we should not necessarily assume that the male left to in Hebrew or even of abomination in Hebrew. But one should not abominate the Edomite. Sorry, can you say 10 times good? At least translate it, but you don't translate it yet. And these translations are on the whole. There's a Latin script, and I can't translate it, they're all translated as a figure. You can, in the middle of reading Saratokian notes on the translation available. The point that you just can't do it. You can't, right? Translations are always, translations always miss the original. You have to use them to some degree because you know one language and you have to find somebody to live. You have to recognize that they are still usable. The easiest way to think about it is how you translate puns. But you can't translate puns. But if you think of language, what language means is just the key in the gut. Language is, every word means the deconstruction of synthesis, the knowledge of synthesis. That every word is the composition of every previous use of the word. So the words don't have the same, where's the code of inferring to find them in different languages? You just can't do it. With all that, I should say, I found that if you're interested, you can go to federalinterest.org and you can download my translation of the fun and see if you can translate it. But it's really telling. So when I'm giving a share, as much as possible, my goal is to try and create the simple terms out of context and not to translate the simple terms. You don't get to make up your own mind about anything else. Okay. So if you have abominated the Edomite, for he is your brother, do not abominate him in the street, for you were a Gary and Wayne. What does that do? You are a Gary and Wayne, therefore abominate him in the street. That would make sense. Right? Right. What then does it make to say that you should not, right, that you should not treat the Egyptian as an abomination because you were a Gary and Wayne? So what I want to suggest is that usually we take the formative memory, even on the first night of Passover, and say, the only mitzvah is to remember that they were mean to us, and then God took us out. And it sounds from this verse that actually, at some point, there are three components. You have to remember that we went down to Egypt and they were nice to us. And they treated us in a manner which, they gave us the best land, and they gave one of us political power, and they treated us with all the dignity, and then they were mean to us. And then God took us out. So that means is that the formative memory should not be purely negative. It should not just be they were mean to us and what not we mean to them. But it should also be, we remember what it was like they were great to us. Right? And we should be great to other people, right? To other people like that. So I want to end up by saying that I think
the overall philosophic thesis is that what it means to be Jewish, in the same way that it's true what it means to be anybody, right, to have an identity, is to have a story, and that story is comprised of your memories. So to be Jewish is to have a Jewish face, to have a Jewish memory. And the question then is, what are the defining components of Jewish memory? So I want to suggest, based on the combination of the Khazari and of the sacred social interpretation of Pi Hashem HaKasha, that the critical components of Jewish memory are Egypt and Sinai, and the connection to Egypt and Sinai, and specifically the idea that the God who commands is the God of Egypt, and therefore that the experience of Egypt has to be reflected in your interpretation of Sinai. And then the last one is recognizing that the experience of Egypt, which is the source of Sinai, is not just the experience of having been oppressed and having been saved, but also, the whole experience of Egypt is predicted, because God says, to Abraham, right, know that your generation, your ancestors, that your descendants will be given the land out there, and then they'll be afflicted and oppressed. But it doesn't mean that's how we rule obviously. It doesn't mean that the entirety of the experience of the other that was important to their children is limited to the oppression. And similarly, when Moshe said, I was a ger in an alien land, it doesn't mean he was oppressed, because Moshe has two experiences in alien land. He has the experience of growing up as a prince, and an experience of being a perfectly accepted member of a family of a Goyim. Right? So the experience of being a ger, most of the experience of being a ger is not an experience of oppression. As an experience of what the proper way to treat a ger is. Of a ger in a sense, although in Egypt, living on the part of the daughter and living on the part of the father, and in Egypt, it seems to be more the doing of the father than the doing of the daughter. But I want to suggest that, the Egypt that happens from Sinai is not just the experience of the angry response to injustice, but also the experience of gratitude. And the transformation of gratitude into positive way of simply avoiding negative. So that, thank you very much for inviting me and for
those of you who like this are welcome to check out ProReadership.org, and I like my statistics going up. I have to download. And if you're interested in a fun summer of Midrash, there are the folders of there and some brochures here. And that will give it over to the next person to thank you very much.
Anyone have any questions?
You can share
this. I'll
take questions if there are. Other questions?
Not as you know, they are as individual questions, but when I have two offerings before, they want to hire those
I'm not sure. I just wasn't really sure that it is. I mean, I know that you can tell somebody if you can talk to me about it.
Sure. Yeah.
That would be good.
Whatever
when is that? Like, when is that?
That could be anywhere from 6 to 10.
Yeah.
And a lot of people
are pretty new to this. You have
I guess you're about one.
So then the main memory is in another one is about
of providing diversity on the other side of the man learning, and I can say it the same way, and make sure that all learning is that. But that's the what makes the program easier, because we want you to have the experience itself as you call capacity and not just as you can. And therefore, not that you're going to go off and sound perfect, but we want you to understand what drives those campuses so that you can be a real contributor to the conversation of other associations, how it can tell. And you understand about other things that the things that we want to say before they're in politics. And they're going to tell. I think it's really important. What can I do in the community to make it possible for them to say that? Or, we can have an answer again. That's the goal, is to get that experience, to get really internalize it, how it is that you can honestly commit it. And that was all that we should do. And I absolutely believe it's the right thing wrong on the right thing to do with it. Everything is built for letting through it, and you have to pretend to do it, and I write my tuba, and that's my way to make it part.
Sounds very good, and I may apply, but I can't promise anything, because I'm still considering other options, and it's also just like we have to make money, as well as bring it up.
I could have told it a month ago, but now I can tell you that you just gotta apply it.
Yeah, I know.
That it was kind of just